They are elected by you, I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Article 1 initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federalist Society. On September 17th, the Federalist Society student chapter at Rutgers Law School invited Dr. Colleen Sheehan of Arizona State University for a great Constitution Day program titled Inside the Mind of James Madison. We hope you enjoy this interesting presentation.
All right. Well, welcome everyone to our Constitution Day event. My name, for those of you who don't know me and are new to the Federalist Society here at Rutgers, my name is Nick DiBenedetto. I am the president of our chapter for this year, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all to a great event today. Our guest today is Dr. Colleen A. Sheehan. She is the director of graduate studies at the Arizona State School of Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership. She recently has published The Cambridge Companion to the Federalist, along with Jack Rakoff. And she is also the author of several books, including The Mind of James Madison, The Legacy of Classical Republicanism, James Madison and the Spirit of Republican Self-Government, and Friends of the Constitution, Writings of the Other Federalists, with Gary McDowell. She has her BA in Political Science from Eisenhower College, her MA in Government from Claremont Graduate School, and her PhD in Political Philosophy and American Government from Claremont. We are very pleased that she is able to join us today on this Constitution Day to tell us all about the constitutional thought of the father of the Constitution, James Madison. Dr. Sheehan, take it away.
Thank you very much, Nick, and it's a pleasure to see you and work with you again. A fellow Villanova Wildcat, once a Villanovan, always a Villanovan. Let's go for another national victory, if at all possible. I hope none of my friends at ASU are watching this. I'll root for them on other sports. Let's talk Madison and the Constitution. Today, as I'm sure you all know, is Constitution Day. The Constitutional Convention that convened in Philadelphia was supposed to start a couple weeks earlier, but people had trouble getting there because of, weather and procrastination and things just taking longer than you think. That happens to all of us. The convention finally got going on May 25th. They had a quorum finally by then. So the Pennsylvania delegates were obviously already there. And the number of the Virginia delegates, including Edmund Randolph, who was then governor of Virginia, and James Madison, were there to start at the appointed time. And so they had a couple weeks to sort of hang out at Franklin's house with the Pennsylvania delegation. And they did a lot of plotting and planning then. A lot of it based on the work that Madison had been doing over quite a number of months leading up to the convention. No one was better prepared for the Constitutional Convention than James Madison. I know you all hear that. It's really true. He just spent months studying. He wrote some notes, which we call memorandum on ancient and modern confederacies. And he just spent months in his study looking at all kinds of confederacies, what had worked, what had not worked. And he really sort of concluded that none of this had worked well. It always ends up that the confederacy is too strong at the center. And so there's not really a confederal government at all. It's really more of a unitary system. Or it's a confederacy in which the states retain or the parts retain their sovereignty. And that's created anarchy, and that it doesn't hold together. So he was looking for some, what he called in his correspondence with Washington and others, some middle ground. And he realized that this was going to be difficult because you can't share sovereignty ultimately. I mean, remember, you're all readers at the Federalist Society of the Federalist Papers, I assume. And if you remember, and at the very end of Federalist 20, remember Federalist 18 through 20 are written by Madison, but they're also, they're sort of joint with Hamilton, because Hamilton provided Madison some notes for those as well. So they agree on this, that you cannot have a sovereign over sovereigns. It's a contradiction in theory, as it is a disaster in practice. So those are some of the things Madison was looking at in the time leading up to the convention. But it wasn't just about federalism. I want you all in the Federalist Society to think about this. I mean, people don't even talk about federalism that much anymore, right? But for Madison, I'm going to posit for your consideration that this wasn't just a compromise on July 16th at the Great at the convention, the Great Compromise, where the Senate was represented by states, you know, two votes per state. I mean, Madison was very opposed to that. He wanted proportional representation. He wanted two houses, but he wanted it proportionate in both houses. He said that's what's consistent with Republican theory. Nonetheless, he lost. He and James Wilson that day, I think they actually thought about whether it was all over and worth saying. They were pretty depressed on July 16th. Nonetheless, they stayed and moved on. I think for Madison, having said that, though, that he thinks of federalism as necessary to republicanism, that it's actually a principle. There's a principle there. It's not a mere compromise. So maybe we can keep that in mind as we think through Madison's ideas. Madison was both, one of the people at the convention who, I don't know how much he didn't engage in the debate very much, but he, you know, he doodled a lot. And he would observe people, the delegate from Georgia, William Pierce, and he would write little character sketches about each of them. And they're really quite lovely. His on Madison is, I think he captures Madison. He says that everybody here recognizes the greatness of Madison, that he's both a politician and a scholar. You know, so I think of Madison as, you know, a scholar and a statesman. But his political instincts, I think, were okay, sometimes good, sometimes not so good. The philosophical part of Madison's being, Madison is America's philosopher. If we've ever had one, it's Madison. Madison thought through what it means to have a free government, popular government, more than anyone of the founding generation. He was the most thoughtful about this. He was the most studious. He went the deepest into these kinds of questions. He read everything he could get his hands on. Plato, Aristotle, Thucydides, Plutarch, I mean, Montesquieu. He spent some very serious time studying Montesquieu. The list goes on and on. Jefferson collected books. Madison read them. don't tell Jeffersonians I said that. There's no way Jefferson read all the books in his library. he just collected them nonstop. In fact, when he moved to Philadelphia to become Secretary of State, here's a footnote, a little aside. You know, Philadelphia wasn't very big those days. It only went really from the river, from Front Street, to about, oh, I don't know, 8th or 9th Street, and Jefferson's house was around there. So just west of Independence Hall, he rented a house. He renovated it. Jefferson was an HGTV, the Candace Olson of the founding generation. He couldn't just rent a house. He did this huge renovation on it, and he added on a book room so that he could transport his many of his books there and have a library in Philadelphia in this rented space, which, by the way, Madison took advantage of right after the first session of Congress to continue his work and his study of republicanism. Okay, so The Constitutional Convention meets from May 25th. It finally gets through the conflict between the Virginia plan, New Jersey plan on July 16th with a great compromise. You know about the three-fifths compromise. It makes it through, and September 17th, it adjourns, sign or die. There are three people who won't sign. Franklin pleads with them, please sign this document, make it unanimous. You don't have to like everything about it. It's not perfect. Nothing in this world is perfect, but it may be the best that we can construct right now. But Elbridge Gerry, Edmund Randolph of the Randolph of Virginia plan, and George Mason of Virginia won't sign. I've always wondered when everybody celebrated after they all signed the document, and you know, Franklin gives his little rising sun speech as he's looking at Washington's chair. He says, you know, I've been looking at that chair all through the convention, and there's a sun on the horizon. And I've wondered, is it a rising sun or a setting sun? And now I have the good fortune to know it's a rising sun. You know, we've done this. I mean, it's only a beginning, because the Constitution is nothing but a dead letter until it's ratified by the people of the several states. And as you know, 9 states are required for it to have gone into operation, which of course means that any state that has not ratified is still not part of the Union. You have to ratify to become part of this perpetual Union of United States of America. So, you know, after they all signed, they adjourned and walked down to City Tavern, which is still there on 2nd Street in Philadelphia. And so there are actually parts of it that are original. I wonder what Elbridge Gerry, George Mason, and Edmund Randolph did that day, spending 4 months with people that are not, many of them not just your colleagues, but your friends. I don't think they went to celebrate with them. I don't know. I guess they that must have been a kind of an odd day for them. Anyway, I don't know if Madison went down to City Tavern or not. He wasn't much of a partier. Unlike Hamilton, whom it's really fun to write books about, because Hamilton or Gouverneur Morris, I mean, these guys are always doing something. Yeah, I mean, Gouverneur Morris, he was just such a ladies' man. You know how he broke his peg leg, because he's, you know, driving his car too fast, his carriage too fast, probably, you know, there's stories about this. and of course, Hamilton, Hamilton was just precocious. I think Hamilton was probably had the highest IQ of all the American founders. I mean, he is as quick as he's just brilliant. He's fast. Even when he's sicker than a dog, he manages to put out these reports that are logically without flaw, beautifully written, and hundreds of pages. But Madison, I think, was the most philosophic, the most thoughtful. Madison, as you know, is called Father of the Constitution. That's debated a lot today. Hadn't been for centuries, and now it's a lot of historians particularly want to argue that he wasn't the father of the Constitution, because so many of the things that he wanted to get into the Constitution didn't make it in there. The negative on state laws, proportional representation in the Senate, Council of Revision, which is a really interesting idea. You wonder what that might have done. I don't think it would have wiped out judicial review, but it might have really controlled the judiciary more if they had their opportunity to be part of saying whether a law is constitutional before the final passage, and the legislature gets to accept or override that beforehand. Then it's going to be a little trickier to say something later on. Anyway, I still consider Madison father of the Constitution. He's the one who thought through the design and the purpose of the Constitution, I think, more than anyone. So think about this. I mean, we all think of the Constitution as a brief, right? A pretty brief set of fundamental law. I don't know if this is true. I heard once, I'm going to repeat it, but only with the caveat that it's funny, but it might not be true, that Nixon once was saying to people, the Constitution is short, it's brief, you should read it. Everybody should read it. I've read most of it. I don't know if that's true. So this thing called the Constitution, that's pretty terse. You know, Article 1 about the legislature, 2 about the executive, 3 about, I mean, it's very logical. It goes in an order. You have to set up the legislature first. So that's Article 1, and that's the legislature's given the bulk of the powers. Separate checks and balances doesn't mean balancing the powers of government in the sense of equalizing them. It means checking them, balancing them in the sense of keeping them within their bounds. But it's the legislature that's given the most power. And so this Constitution is all very logical, but what's it there for? Okay, to keep the rule of law. But law is a means to another end. Law is not an end in and of itself. At least according to Madison, Hamilton, and the founders, the Federalists, if you will, remember in Federalist 51, the summary of all the Federalist Papers from 1 to 51 happens in the center of Federalist 51. And Madison says, justice is the end of government. It is the end of civil society. It ever has been and it ever will be pursued until it be obtained or until liberty be lost in its pursuit. And interestingly enough, in the most beautiful state capitol in the United States, the Pennsylvania State House, if you go into the rotunda and you look up, and I mean, it's just full of quotations and symbolism, but there's one that has, that represents, there's a statue that it represents law. And the quotation under it is, justice is the end of government. It is the end of civil society. Law is a means to obtain justice. That says a lot, but it doesn't say everything that needs to be said, right? Because as Alistair MacIntyre once said and put it in a book title, who's justice? Which rationality, right? You know, I mean, what regimes are, different forms of government are different views of justice. You know, oligarchs have a different view of justice than Democrats, who have a different view of justice than aristocrats, right? And so, look, that's what America is fighting over today. This polarization in America is over two, not just rival, but maybe fundamentally opposed views of what justice is. We all use the words liberty and equality, but we're meaning very, very different things. So different that it's really akin to what was happening leading up to the Civil War. You know, Lincoln said, right now we're in great need of a definition of liberty. Everybody's saying it, but we mean very, very different things about this. And I think that's what's going on today. Anyway, so what is Madison's vision of this thing called justice that he sees as the end of the Constitution? Well, the interpretation of Madison that was, maybe still is, it's certainly powerful still, whether it's dominant or not, I'm not sure, but that has certainly been dominant for many, many, many years, is the idea that Madison was basically a pluralist. Robert Dahl writes about this. And that what he's trying to do, really, his idea of justice is really just sort of the prevention of injustice. Let's have a multiplicity of interests and a multiplicity of religious sects. And what we can do is prevent people from arguing over really important regime questions. And get rid of this this bipolarization between the rich and the poor that tends to destroy regimes. And so to do that, his solution is the extended republic, representation, separation of powers, federalism, bicameralism, checks and balances. That's pretty much the summary. And it's meant to lower the ends of government. He's not going to try to do what the classics did. He doesn't care about character formation. He doesn't. We can be a nation of devils, but out of this can come a certain thing called the common good. Now, this common good is pretty low, but as Martin Diamond says, our ends are low but solid. Maybe it's pretty much materialistic. It's, Diamond says, vulgar, crass. It's all of these things. You know, we're sort of, we took Machiavelli's advice, and Madison in particular. He devised shrewd institutional arrangements, force and counterforce, and let's just stop things and go to the lowest common denominator to prevent the grossest forms of injustice and revolution, stasis. That's been the, and his major goal is just protection of property rights. And so, and preventing, and so when it comes to things like what kind of human beings we are, how we live our lives, well, let a thousand flowers bloom, you know, do as you will. That's been the interpretation of Madison for a long, long time. And that's what the Constitution is meant to do. That's why there's separation of powers, checks and balances, federalism. That's why the territory is so large. It's to prevent any one major view from gaining predominance. Because once that does, it could be a factious view. And then what you're going to end up with is hatred and envy and ultimately regime change. Okay. I've spent pretty much my adult life studying Madison, and I have to say that's not my view of Madison. In fact, it is almost 100, it's almost 180 degrees different. It's not totally different in the sense that, yes, there's separation of powers, all those things, that's all true. Force, counterforce, Madison agrees with Montesquieu about all of that. It's a way to prevent injustice and tyranny. Remember, a faction by definition is a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest, adverse to the rights of others or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. So a faction by definition is unjust. Madison wants the Newtonian Montesquieuian idea of force, counterforce to prevent this kind of faction and injustice from ruling. And thus the extended republic is helpful to that. The idea isn't to create more factions. It's that to comprehend more so that it's harder for there to be a dominant interest or faction. But Madison doesn't want it to be impossible. He wants it to be difficult so that you have to build a coalition so that in that space and the time it's going to take to do that, something's going to happen then. Space and time for Madison is critically important. That time is to be used for Republican deliberation, to refine and enlarge the public views. It's a kind of civic education that the system itself is conducive to, because during this time in this large territory, you're gonna have to have representatives who go back and forth from the seat of government to their, you know, home districts, home states, and talk with the people there. Listen to the, if they wanna be reelected, they've gotta listen to the people there. If their views are different, then they've got to try to take on the role of statesman and persuade them otherwise. If they want to keep their seats and they're more than just finger to the wind, then their job is going to be to persuade to a better understanding of what's required for the common good. So that back and forth of the representatives, and then when they go to Congress, then there's more deliberation there. There's supposed to be. I think we should reinstitute a requirement that when Congress is in session, you have to be in your seat. You can't require them to listen, but you can require them to be on the House floor. So that what's going to happen then is they're going to end up listening to some of it. I served in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, and that was a requirement for us, and it actually makes a difference. You end up, you're hearing what's going on, and you start thinking about arguments other people are giving. Then Madison also talked about newspapers circulating throughout the land, and people, the literati, writing, public intellectuals writing and persuading people, you know, disagreeing, and in that disagreement comes a second thought. And isn't that what education is? But this is education in the civic arena. And so Madison's idea is that we do want, and these are his words, a common cause in spite of circumstantial and artificial distinctions. Madison says that's the Republican way. It's not just to prevent factions. It's so that Republican principles will inform our way of thinking and inform the legislation that a coalition of a majority of the whole society ultimately comes to. And so in that, well, it's no guarantee. He's worked very hard to design a system that's conducive to that. Now you need real human beings on top of that. It's not just mechanical. You need statesmen and stateswomen who are willing to, as Hamilton says, and the Federalist Papers, sometimes they have to even be willing to do their duty at every hazard, to risk losing the election when it's that important. And that's always going to be a requirement in the most extraordinary circumstances. So that's the Madison I've come to know in my study of him. I want to make sure there's time here for Q&A and for discussion. So let me conclude with this. There, if some of the scholars have gotten Madison so very wrong over the years, and because what Madison is talking about is that, as he says in Federalist 39, that only a Republican form of government will be in accordance with the genius, he means the character of the American people, and with the principles of the revolution and with that honorable determination in which we engage in the great experiment in self-government. That is what Madison is about. That's the design. That's the purpose behind the design of the Constitution. Is to find a way for the first time in the history of the world. It had never really worked before. Reread Federalist 9. Hamilton says in Federalist 9, every attempt to do this, to the extent that it succeeded, has been so short-lived. The ancient petty republics of ancient Greek and Rome, while there are momentary rays of glory that break forth through the gloom, and while they dazzle us with a fleeting brilliance, in the end, it's failure. A people had never demonstrated that they could actually govern themselves, that free government, popular government could work because of the problem of faction. And Madison's goal, he thinks he's found a way that we can make this work, is for the first time in the history of the world to design a political order, a republic, that could go on through the ages. Now, there's no guarantee because it has to be paid forward all the time. Self-government is an ongoing task for every generation. The Constitution is just the framework with it, which enables us to do that if we are willing to put forth the work of self-government. There's one fellow in particular who really gets Madison, and he's not an historian. Not a scholar, he's a poet, Robert Frost. At Kennedy's inaugural, Frost was supposed to give his newly composed poem that Kennedy asked him to write for him called Dedication. And Frost is, you know, in his 80s, his eyes aren't good. It just snowed and the sun had come out. It was brilliant and the sun was reflecting off the snow, and Frost is trying to read this poem he's just written for Kennedy. He can't see it. And there's a black and white tape of this on the internet. You should look it up. And you can see Jackie Kennedy is like, I think she puts her hand on, I think it's LBJ's arm. It's like, help this poor man, you know? I mean, and it's a very awkward moment. Finally, Frost, somebody tries to go up and hold a hat and shade it. And he just pushes them away and he puts the papers down. He says, I think I'll say a poem that I know by heart. It's a poem about what Madison may have thought. These are Frost's words. It's a poem about what Madison may have thought. And here's that poem. The land was ours before we were the land's. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts, in Virginia, but we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by, possessed by what we now no more possessed. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found out it was ourselves. We were withholding from our land of living and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war. To the land, vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become. I think this is a poem about self-government. You see, the land was ours. We owned it materially before we were the lands, before we really became Americans. It means something to be American. We are informed not by a common ethnicity, a common religion, a common race. We're informed by a common idea and a common experiment. And that experiment, as Washington said, for which the sacred fire of liberty guards over, is the great experiment in self-government. Let me conclude with what Franklin said that day as he walked out of Independence Hall. And a woman said to him, well, did you do it? Have you got it? He says, yeah, it's a republic if you can keep it. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sheehan. We have just a few minutes for Q&A. So I ask that anybody who has questions, please either use the hand raise feature in the participants tab or shoot me a message in the chat and we can start going through them. I can lead us off as we're waiting for some questions. And my question is, Dr. Sheehan, there's been a lot of discussion recently about how technology has kind of taken this idea of the extended republic and really kind of compressed it, and how the problems of the small republic seem to be coming back. And I think there's a lot to that. But my question is, can we take heart in the fact that over the last several years, there's been an explosion, it seems, of alternative media that gives us more substance? If you look at podcasts or YouTube lectures or different things like that, you have an apparent hunger for longer discussion, things that cable news just can't satisfy, more than just a 5-minute soundbite, but where people can take an hour or two or even three to really delve into an issue and explore it in greater depth.
Yeah, great question, Nick. I mean, one of the things that counteracts the problem that the small republic faces, which is what? It's the ease of forming majority faction. That's the problem of the small republic. It's too easy to form majority factions. There's no time built in to this small space. And you need time to have deliberation, because otherwise it's too easy to have a contagion of passion. Which, you know, some passions are diseased, you know, unjust, prejudice, or it's too easy to have a common interest that's too big and can tyrannize over the others. The large republic's supposed to take care of that, but why did that change? Well, all the forms of communication. This is Madison's theory. His theory is a theory of communication. And he says that the things that allow us to communicate easier, and he's already, remember, he's the last of the founders to live, and he's seen the steam engine come about. And he talks about the increased communication is equivalent to a contraction of the territorial limits. These are his words. So the republic becomes smaller. What's happened today is the world is a smaller place because of the ease of communication. And once you add the internet onto telephone, telegraph, and all that, it's a game changer. And so things can, I mean, what we call it going viral. This is Madison's nightmare, going viral, because there's no room for slowing things down, getting people to think, you know, it's a too quick and an unthoughtful response often. So that is a problem, but it's here. So we have to find other ways to counteract that. Civic education is one of these, and the format you're talking about would be that type of thing. Federalism is critical to this, because federalism, part of what federalism is about, the place of states and localities, is meant to break this up and create these layers that we have. It's, think of it like a board game, a classic board game, right? You want these obstacles that slow you down. That's what makes the game, that's what makes the game. That doesn't mean that the game is never to get anywhere. For Madison, it's to get around the board, but he wants all these obstacles that slow things down. So federalism is really important as one of these. It's to slow things down, but it's points of refinement and enlargement. That's read his essay that he wrote 1791-92, published in the National Gazette, called Consolidation. And he lays it out there, the importance of the states and localities. He sees this long before Tocqueville does. So this is one suggestion. And then the other thing, I think the other big thing that's needed to counteract this is reducing the administrative state and the centralization. That has just made it way too easy for these kinds of things to happen, and it's exacerbated by the ease of communication.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions? I see that Tommy has a question. Tommy, unmute yourself and ask your question.
Hey, Dr. Sheehan, thanks for coming. I wanted to ask you, as a Madison expert, was there any particular depiction of Madison in media or pop culture that you thought was, you know, really accurate? And then conversely, is there anyone that you thought like, wow, that's really just, I really doubt that Madison was like that. You know, we've had Hamilton that came out recently, and a while back, John Adams, the HBO miniseries. And I just wondered if there was any movie or anything where you really were like, that's a good one, or, you know, that's terrible. I know it's not a constitutional law question or anything like that, but I'm sorry.
I love it. It's a great question. But my answer is Madison's so neglected by pop culture that there aren't really many depictions of him. Think about it. I mean, they barely paid any attention to him in the play Hamilton. You know, I actually think in 1770, is it 1776 when they say, sit down, John, sit down, you know, I think they got Adams right. I mean, Madison thought Adams could be pretty obnoxious. No, I mean, we don't have this about Madison, and we don't even have a statue in Washington for Madison. Madison has been hugely neglected, even though he more than anyone thought through the vision of America. So I see the guitars in your background. Maybe it's time to do something Madisonian for pop culture.
Does anyone else have any questions before we conclude?
Hey, Dr. Sheehan. My name is Chris. I'm sorry I attended the event a bit late. I was just getting an assignment from a judge. But first and foremost, thanks for inviting me. I enjoyed the history that you provided with James Madison. I'm not sure if I missed this, but if James Madison went to a time machine and, you know, he came and saw what we're doing right now, Is there something that he would tell us to do differently? Is there something that he would really enjoy? And I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Oh, wow. Wow, what a great question, Chris. I mean, of course, this is all speculation, but I like to speculate, so let me go ahead. And, I mean, I don't know, but I'm willing to you know, give what I think is an intelligent guess. America's at a crossroads right now. I am very worried with this next election, no matter who wins, that there's not only going to be rioting in the streets, but it might not be controllable. That we might be in for some real anarchical behavior. I mean, look, this is the stuff revolutions are made of, and no regime lasts forever. And America's on borrowed time right now, given the way we're acting. And Madison would be very concerned about this. Because what are the alternatives? The alternatives are anarchy and tyranny generally, when there's a revolution. You create so much instability. The United States is not, we are unstable right now. This is not good. How do we find our way back? I think that's one thing he'd be very, very concerned about. And the other thing, in terms of the, you know, what we're fighting about is so fundamental. We're fighting with the two sides. They're basically two sides and then another group of people trying to figure out what's happening. This isn't just race. This is primarily over ideology. And I mean ideology in the real sense. It's a difference over what it means to be human and how we should live our lives. That's what's going on in the country. And that is as fundamental as it could be. This is going to take incredible patience and moderation on the part of people in order to try to hang in there together and find where we can find common cause, if we can, again. And Madison would be not just concerned, he'd be alarmed at the current situation. We're in a bad place.
I think we've got time.
Can we end on a happier note?
Please.
This is the work of your generation, though, to do something about this. We, having said what I just said, we have faced something at least as tough as this before, or pretty close to it. I think this might even be a little bit tougher. And of course, that was the time leading up to the Civil War, which was a fundamental disagreement. That was a disagreement over who's human. Our disagreement today is not over who's human. It's over what it means to be human, how we should live our lives, what freedom means, what equality means, what justice means. I mean, it's a regime principle. But we managed before. I mean, okay, there was a war. But we did find our way back. There was a new birth of freedom. Let's hope, I'm hoping your generation will find a way. You guys are center stage right now. There's work to be done. And it's not just a partisan kind of question. It's a regime question. It's about not just the future of America, but the survival of America. So this whole pay it forward thing of Madisonian self-government right now is the time when we need to be getting people to engage in dialogue and talking about fundamental principles. And remember that old Joni, you guys are too young, there's an old Joni Mitchell song. How does that go? You don't know what you've got till it's gone. They pave paradise and put up a parking lot. We need to wake up and figure it. And I think there's a whole huge part of America that's still very healthy. I call it middle America. And you guys need to be writing op-eds, and you need to not just do your law work right now. You need to do public service, civic service. And we need to talk with our fellow citizens about realizing what we have and not letting it go. And then so that afterwards it's gone. And then we realize what we've lost. I wish the situation weren't as serious, but I think it is. So I'm asking you, I'm pleading with you. Civic service right now is really important. If you can engage in that in some way, it'll be well. I don't know if it'll be worth your effort, but your effort is required nonetheless.
And on that note, thank you all very much for attending. And I'd like to give a very warm thank you to Dr. Sheehan once again. Enjoy Constitution Day, and we will see you in early October for our next event. Thank you all very much.
It's a republic if you can keep it.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/Article I. That's fedsoc.org/Article I.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.